Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, March 10th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. Now, we've had some very striking developments in the last couple of days, and I'll just mention a couple of these, but you really need to go on to the LaRouchePack.com website to get the deeper picture. But most important was a resolution introduced by Congressman Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina. It's House Concurrent Resolution 107, and it essentially asserts the Constitution. His resolution says that any president who would try to initiate offensive military action without going to the Congress, without the consent of Congress, is committing an impeachable act. And this is very significant because it's the first time we've had this is not just an abstraction, it's in the very moment that President Obama, the British puppet, went before the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and said that he's prepared to take military action if necessary to stop Iran from developing nuclear weapons. And so he's not gone to the Congress. He's carrying out at the same time plans for an attack on Syria. And so the Jones resolution is extremely important, and I want our listeners to go to that, get it off the website, and take it around to people. And we should put every congressman on notice. Every congressman took an oath to uphold the Constitution, to defend the Constitution of the United States. So Jones's resolution merely states this is what the Constitution says about warfare. And so we have to ask every congressman, do you support the Constitution or not? Because if you do, you should sign this resolution. And if you don't, we're going to run you out of the Congress, buddy. So that's one development. The other development, and I'll just reference this, is our old friend from France, who's been a frequent guest on this program, Jacques Cheminade, the head of the Solidarité et Progrès Party, filed his signatures of mayors this week. 538 mayors in France signed to put him on the presidential ballot. And this led to a literal feeding frenzy in the press. There were over 100 articles in the papers yesterday and today about the Cheminade campaign. And of course, what Jacques is emphasizing is the need to take every measure possible to avoid war in the Middle East and to go toward the Franklin Roosevelt policies of Glass-Steagall and a credit policy for France. And Jacques has a great deal of credibility, and we'll probably have him on as a guest in the next couple of weeks as the campaign heats up. Now, in the midst of all this fighting to stop the war, the mobilization that we've been on since the end of October, and since we're still here, you actually owe a debt of gratitude to Lyndon LaRouche and the LaRouche organization for our mobilization, and then to, ironically, members of the U.S. military command, retired military, the intelligence community, as well as retired Israeli military and intelligence personnel who have been mobilized to stop the war. But in the midst of this mobilization, we had an extraordinary conference in Berlin, February 24th and 25th, the basic theme of which was war avoidance from the highest standpoint, the assertion of Republican policies and what it means to be a human being from the standpoint of politics and science. And we have as our guest today one of the participants in that conference who delivered a speech there, and you can find his speech on LaRouchePack.com, and that is my longtime associate, Bruce Director. So, Bruce, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, Harley.
Now, you know, sometimes you get this from our contacts. They say, well, I love the science work you do, but I just don't see the connection to the politics or the economics. And, of course, there's a reason for that, which is that they're essentially brought up in a society which says there is no connection. And as you pointed out in your presentation, they're also told there's no connection between the human mind and the universe in which we live. And I think the way you started your presentation by going after that paradox was actually a very interesting way to get into the subject matter. So I'd like you to start with that, because this question of the relationship of how we think about how we think about our ontological existence is actually is directly connected to the physical universe. It's not something, we don't exist outside of it, observing it. So why don't you begin with that, because I think that's a very useful way to get into this very sometimes difficult subject matter.
Well, start with what you began with, which is the resolution that Walter Jones put, Congressman Walter Jones put into the Congress. Here we're faced with a situation where we have a British Empire which is collapsing. They've made it very clear that they want to threaten nuclear war against Russia and China in order to assert their authority to maintain a domination over the world and to push the world into a policy of depopulation. They have a puppet in the White House, President Obama, who has his finger on enough nuclear weapons that if you were to release even a tenth of those, you could wipe out the entire human race. Not to mention how many weapons would be unleashed by Russia and China and every other nuclear power if such a conflagration were to take place. So we have a situation right now where physically the human race could become extinct much faster than the dinosaurs. You know, there's a lot of speculation as to how long it took the dinosaurs to become extinct, whether it was a mass extinction event that took just a few years, or whether it played out over several hundred years. But in the case of the human race, with the threat of nuclear war, you're talking about the potential for the extinction of the human race within 20 minutes. And that's physically possible. I'm not saying that's going to happen, but that we all know that that scenario is possible. And the difference between whether or not that happens and that doesn't happen is not a physical question, but an act of human will. It's what goes on in the minds of the population, but especially of key leaders in those countries. And we look back through human history, and we see that civilizations rise and fall, great catastrophes befall mankind based on decisions that people make. So that fact, the fact that the power of the human mind to make a willful decision can either determine or whether or not the human race becomes extinct, or whether or not we make a different decision to adopt the kinds of policies which LaRouche has been insisting on, and we get cooperation between Russia, China, and the United States initially, along with other countries joining in, for the kind of large-scale development projects and space exploration which could lead mankind into a new phase of our development in the solar system and beyond.
And I think it's very important to recognize the action by Congressman Jones from that higher standpoint, the question of extinction or non-extinction. You might quibble, why didn't he just do a bill of impeachment against Obama? Why didn't he do something more explicit? But the fact is that this is in a context where U.S. military leaders have been speaking out, because the U.S. military leaders, including Dempsey, the chairman, General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, these guys know that we are on a collision course toward thermonuclear war if the British Obama policies continued. So merely asserting the Constitution and the impeachable offense of not going to the Congress is a very significant action from that standpoint of the extinction or non-extinction of humanity.
Absolutely, and it also demonstrates a real scientific principle, which is that the human mind is an efficient power in and over the universe. It actually determines the direction of the universe, and to the extent that the human mind determines, you know, how wide an extent that is obviously something that is a subject of investigation. But the fact that the human mind is an efficient power in and over the universe tells us something not just about the human mind, but about the universe itself. Why is the universe susceptible to being organized according to the discoveries that arise both within an individual human mind, and how those discoveries in an individual human mind resonate and radiate throughout its contemporaries and also across the generations. And that is a real, that's the key point. And when you look at the history of the development of science, you look at all the discoveries and achievements in the area that we call science, which is the discoveries of principles that govern the universe, but I would also say we should extend that to discoveries of principles we would call art, which are really discoveries about how the mind works. So these two types of discoveries, discoveries about the nature of man and discoveries about the nature of the universe outside of man. And if you look at the history of the development of these ideas, you see that it's through the development in this domain of ideas that we have seen a change in the organization of the universe. Man invents new forms of organization and existence, new forms of matter, new forms of energy, new forms of life, new aspects of extension of man's control over living and non-living processes, to the point where the power of the human mind is a driving force within the universe, and it indicates that the universe is organized according to a principle which in modern science we call anti-entropic. That is, it's a principle that you could say is consistent with human creativity. It has a quality, the universe itself has an intrinsic quality to generate new states of organization and existence and to develop from lower orders to higher orders. And that goes against the prevailing idea in reductionist science today that the universe is essentially always tending towards equilibrium. And my argument in the presentation in Berlin and also the investigations and research from the basement and everything that LaRouche has done in economics shows that the universe is tending exactly the opposite direction, and that it's only the oligarchy in the British Empire which wants to impose this false idea of a universe tending towards equilibrium for political reasons.
Now, Bruce, I think this is one of the important questions. Your topic was the ending the tyranny of the second law of thermodynamics. And, you know, when people approach this question of the British Empire, there's a tendency to think about gunboats and red coats and things of that sort, and not to understand the nature of empire the way Lyndon LaRouche has been developing it. But what you did in your presentation was to demonstrate that this was actually a form of warfare against humanity. And you started by talking about this question of potential relative population density and the fact that mankind has developed these capabilities to increase the population, and yet, in specific, you pointed to the second law of thermodynamics as one of the key instruments being used to destroy civilization. So take us through that a little bit, because this is something that you've discussed quite a bit. It's been something that Lyndon LaRouche has taken up for years, but it's something that I think our listeners don't fully appreciate yet, why they have to take up these scientific questions on the nature of man and the relationship to the universe.
Well, look, go back to what you just said about the empire. I mean, empires rule and on the basis of controlling the mind. The things that people accept as basic principles for the organization of their lives and society is based on how they think the universe works. It's not based on somebody holding, controlling them, everything they do by force. That might happen in some situations, but it's basically by controlling the way people think of the world. Take it, you know, our ancient examples of imperial systems like the Babylonian system or the Persian system. How did these systems perpetuate themselves over centuries with myths like the gods of Olympus, that there were a certain select few gods who had superpowers over everybody else, and most people were kept in a condition of stupidity and therefore slavery because they were induced to believe in myths and legends and mysteries about how the world works.
It's a form of self-enslavement once you buy into that.
Exactly, and that's what we have today. People think about the world not based on any competent development of the qualities of their mind to investigate how the world works, but they have rattling around in their heads, you know, stuff that's imposed on them both in their education but also by popular culture. Look at the view of man, which is conveyed by Hollywood movies or popular books or television or whatever, God knows what people find on the internet. So it's really how the mind thinks in the population which determines how an empire thinks and the power of an empire. And the one of the consistent concepts of imperial science and culture is that there's the world of the mind, and then there's the universe. And once you induce people to accept that in whatever form it is, then you can get people to you can cede power socially to an oligarchy, which says, well, we know how the world works, and we have the power here. So whatever new ideas you may come up with, whatever you think about the creative powers of the human mind, these are immaterial to the universe. The universe is going to go ahead according to what we say, not according to anything you can do. All life is ultimately futile.
Well, it imposes a kind of passivity. But beyond that, you have a situation where people literally do become enslaved to perception.
Exactly. Take, for example, what we all know that dominated feudal Europe from the murder of Archimedes on through the Renaissance, which was this Aristotelian cosmology that the earth was at the center and didn't move, and that everything revolved around the earth. But that on the earth, everything was corrupted because it was all changing. It was born and it died. It decayed. That the characteristic of the earth was all change. And that as you got further and further away from the earth to the moon, to the planets, to the stars, etc., things changed less and less and less. And so that this is a model of the organization of the universe, which is consistent with a model of an imperial society, which is that you may change in your life, you may grow, you may develop, you may have ideas, but what doesn't change is the eternal power of the oligarchy to prevent change from happening.
But it's also that the idea that change itself is something that undermines the natural order of perfection.
Exactly. And so for 1,500 years, people lived in a state of slavery, with certain exceptions, but they lived in a state of slavery because they accepted the imperial order as the form of social organization which was most consistent with the way they believed the universe to work. And today we have that in the form of what is called the second law of thermodynamics, which first of all is a fraud. I can go into that in a minute, but it basically states that everything in the universe is tending towards a state of equilibrium, which is a state of no change, because once you reach equilibrium, there's nothing more to do. You can't get more equilibrium than equilibrium. So therefore, any attempt to work against anything that man does that disrupts this equilibrium is A, dangerous, and B, futile. For example, the green ideology. The green ideology has people running around thinking that somehow there's some balance in nature, that nature's trying to maintain a state of equilibrium, and that anything man does is a disruption into that state of equilibrium. But this is absurd because there is no balance in nature. As the research of the basement team has shown, if you go back and you look at the history of the evolution of life on the earth, which we have a pretty good understanding of, even though there's a lot we don't understand, you see that the life is always developing from lower to higher states of organization, that you're getting more and more advanced states of life, that the evolution of living forms interacts with the earth in such a way as to change everything on the earth, gaining increasing dominance. For example, the emergence of an oxygen atmosphere as a result of the development of these kinds of bacteria and plants that exhale oxygen and are able to use carbon dioxide, all these kinds of things, the development of organisms that can live outside of the ocean and move on to land, which brings the water from the ocean onto the land, and that changes the water cycle and so forth on the in the earth. And along with this evolutionary development, you see that the effect of the process of living, of growth of life, has produced a sufficient changes in the earth, organization of the earth, in such a way that you have these mass extinctions. You have times when the dominant forms of life on the planet disappear, and forms of life which are more advanced become dominant. And if you look at the history of the evolution of life, as I think Cody Jones once pointed out, you never have a point in which a lower form of life takes over from a higher form of life. Mm-hmm. It always goes from the lower to the higher. The mammals, for example, are a higher form of organization of life than the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs.
He used the example of going from cold-blooded to warm-blooded as being a very significant shift in the capability of organisms to survive.
Exactly, and there's numerous examples of that. But you can't find any examples in the other direction. You can't find any time in the evolution of life where a higher form of life gives way to a lower form of life. So if you look at the development of life on Earth, you see that the Earth is being organized from lower to higher states of organization and existence. And then if you look at things which are beyond the Earth, so you think they're beyond the scope of life, such as the Crab Nebula or supernovas or other kinds of things, you see that the more we investigate these kinds of astrophysical processes, and also in the other direction, microphysical ones, we see that things which we don't consider to be part of life, to actually be striving in that direction, to be going from lower to higher states. Instead of tending towards equilibrium, they tend the other way. For example, in the Crab Nebula, which is supposed to be the remnants of an exploded star. Now, when you think of an explosion, you think you have a big explosion, and then everything flies out, and then it sort of dissipates into some equilibrium state.
Right.
But when you look at the Crab Nebula, which is supposed to be an exploded star, you see that it's not dissipating into an equilibrium state, but is actually organizing into some forms of organization which do things that defy all our known physics. So the more we gain knowledge of how the universe is working, we see that equilibrium is actually not a natural state, but the one that the universe keeps tending away from. Now, there are specific limited cases in what are called closed systems, mm-hmm. where you tend to have a tendency in the direction towards equilibrium, for example, in the flow of heat in a heat power machine, mm-hmm. from hot to cold, which is the theory behind a heat power machine, that the reason why you can turn a wheel with heat is because you have a hot gas and you allow it to expand to lose its heat, and the expansion causes the turn of a wheel, for example, in an internal combustion engine. Mm-hmm. And Sadi Carnot in the early part of the 19th century did a whole study of how this works in order to understand the maximum efficiency of a heat-powered machine. For the simple reason that, you know, it wasn't until the 17th century that man actually began to use heat as a power source. For all of our existence, we use fire, which distinguished man from the animals. We were the only creature that used fire. But we use fire not as a power source, not to run machines. We used it to melt things or to heat things or to cook things. But most of our power was muscle power, gravity power, or in some limited cases, wind power.
Water power would be a form of gravity power.
Exactly, because yeah. the water flows from the high gravity to the lower gravity, or down towards lower. But with gravity, the water can flow downhill, but you can also, with a pump, make the water go uphill. Well, in the case of heat, you can't make the heat go from the cold to the hot. So this is an interesting contrast. And so if you're trying to understand, well, how do we use this power of heat? It doesn't work the same way as gravity. It appears on first thing to have something similar to gravity, but there's some difference to it. So This, of course, leads in, scientifically into a very interesting direction in the 19th century, starting with Riemann and ending with Planck and Einstein, in which scientists began to realize that these different things, heat, light, magnetism, electricity, were all really the same thing. And different ways in which these were artificial divisions that were conformed to our sense perception. We feel heat with our skin, with our sense of touch, and we detect light with our eyes. But the more you look into the phenomenon of heat and light, you actually see that you're looking at, it's just the only difference between the two of them is that they're the same thing that we perceive differently through different senses. But when you get beyond the domain of sense perception, heat and light are actually the same physical phenomena. Now, Einstein got us to the point where we understood that heat and light and gravity, I mean, heat and light, electricity and magnetism were all the same thing, but then there's this question of what is gravity, and we're still grappling with that. But that's another question. But we know from a scientific standpoint that even though we haven't solved that problem of the what is the nature of gravity, how do you reconcile gravity with electromagnetism, that we know that it must be. That there must be a single universe, and that what appears to us as two different forces, so to speak, are really not two different forces, but really two different expressions of some other principle which we haven't discovered yet.
Well, just let me just remind our listeners, you're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is the program for March 10th, 2012. The LaRouche Show is on every Saturday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, and then it's archived on LaRouchePub.com. And we've had a series of discussions recently that have taken up some of these really groundbreaking matters, both in terms of politics, economics, science. We've had people from the basement on. And help us build the audience for this show. And get your friends also to go to the LaRouchePack.com every single day, because we have a lot of the material that Bruce is discussing is being presented, the breakthroughs in the basement, every Wednesday on the weekly report. Now, Bruce, you said you were going to get back to this question, the second law of thermodynamics. I'd like you to develop it from the standpoint that, you know, from what you've just described, it would seem so self-evident, or not self-evident, but evident to someone who can think, that you do have this move from lesser to more order, to higher order, higher energy. The chart that you showed on population then corresponds to the developments that we see in advances in energy flux density. And yet, there's clearly a completely different conception of how the universe works that's presented in the second law of thermodynamics. So I'd like you to just give a sense of what it is and then how they get away with it.
Well, here you have to go back to politics again, because when you look at the development of heat as a power, it comes out of Leibniz's discovery of dynamics, and it represented a complete revolution, an extension of really what began with Da Vinci in the Renaissance, exemplary by that. But you had this advance in technology, which made it possible for man to get increasing dominance over the universe and be able to increase the standard of living and the population and the power per capita in that population.
And that should be the normal development of human civilization.
Oh, absolutely. And it also requires that that it is the effect of the development of the human mind. And it requires a continued development of the human mind. And this is why Leibniz, who was a scientist, was also a politician and an economist. And he, was part of a movement in Germany, a leader of a movement in Europe, that recognized that if you want to improve the condition of man, you have to improve the condition of the mind, improve the quality of the mind. And this was taken up, obviously, by Benjamin Franklin and codified or organized into what became the United States as a republic, enshrined in our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, and in the economic policies of the first Washington administration of Hamilton that created the condition by which the purpose of the government was to improve the qualities of the mind as expressed through the development of science and technology. And this threatened the British Empire because this was going to spread, as it did, to Germany. It was spreading to Russia. And at in the middle of the 19th century, you had the victory of Lincoln over the Confederacy. But not only did he win the Civil War, he created the United States as an industrial republic, where you had the Transcontinental Railroad, the land-grant colleges, all these things we know about. And this was spreading to Germany and Russia. And so you had, if you were in the middle of the 19th century, you could see basically two different worlds. One was, just like today, one was, you know, a real burst in science and technology and power per capita and the benefits that were accruing to people as a result of their ability to transform man's relationship to nature. And the other, you had this rotting, dying, decrepit Victorian British Empire, which was prowling the seas and controlling finance and trying to loot people. So the problem was to introduce into science a new view of the universe that was consistent with the empire, but would keep pace with all the breakthroughs in science. So the first stab took place by this guy, William Thomson, who later became known as Lord Kelvin. And he said, well, when you look at heat-powered machines, you see that the heat ultimately dissipates into mechanical energy. And since all mechanical energy ultimately then dissipates into heat, and since everything in the universe is ultimately mechanical, the universe is going to end up someday in a mass heat death in which all motion stops. He wrote a paper called on mechanical systems, and he had a section called on the ultimate dissipation of heat in the universe. So this view of the universe is that, no, okay, so we have all these machines, we have everything else, but all they're doing is changing heat into mechanical energy, which then goes back into heat again, and sooner or later everything's going to be dead into equilibrium. So anything man does is all futile, and you might as well not engage in it and just let the British Empire try and manage equilibrium as it is. So that was not, even though Thomson was somewhat of a skilled engineer, this sort of strange religious doctrine was not really fit for science. So,
Bruce, at that point in time, you're talking now in the mid-19th century.
Yeah, about the 1840s, 1850s.
You had had this fight in the early part of the 17th century, or I'm sorry, the 18th century, of Newton versus Leibniz. So you actually we've been through these kinds of battles before. What happens to the people who actually understand that what Kelvin is saying is a fraud?
Well, you see, the agenda of history is actually set by creative thinkers. You know, Aristotle was a reaction to Plato. Newton was a reaction to Kepler. You didn't have, it wasn't that Newton's ideas were accepted. Kepler showed that the universe, the organization of the solar system, was not as Aristotle said, but was consistent with human creativity. So Newton, they couldn't revive Aristotle because Kepler had shown Aristotle was wrong. So they revived Newton, who very cleverly introduced the idea of absolute space and absolute time in order to sort of take the passion, take the creativity out of Kepler's idea of the universe. Mm-hmm. And then Leibniz came around and showed that Newton was a complete fraud. And then the British oligarchy ran a slander campaign against Leibniz in order to discredit him. And you had this fight all throughout the 18th and 19th century between the Leibnizians and the Newtonians.
Well, and then even in the beginning of the 20th century, the Einstein work on relativity demolished the idea of absolute space and absolute time.
Yeah, that was an extension of the same thing.
Yeah, but we still have Newton presented as the exemplar of science.
Yeah, the way they say it is that Newton works as far as, you know, if you limit it to certain things, and then you have to go into, you know, if you look at the world in certain limited domains where speeds are relatively slow compared to the speed of light, then the idea of absolute time and absolute space works fine. It's only when you get into relativistic matters that it becomes different. They treat it mathematically.
And my point to this is that at a certain point, truth is no longer the subject of science. It's just what seems to work.
And that's exactly the point. So in the 19th century, at this point, the British were trying to have it both ways. How can we get the benefits of technology for our own maintenance of our empire without the threat to our empire that comes from unleashing the intellectual and cultural benefits of science and technology, which is to free mankind up to recognize that it's the power of their minds which is a factor in the universe. So they introduced this second law of thermodynamics as sort of a ruse to get people to accept the fact that we can have progress as long as it's under the control of the empire.
Now, you pointed out that Kelvin's work was really somewhat limited, and it had to be upgraded by Boltzmann and...
First, Rudolf Clausius, who rewrote, did a revision of Carnot's work, and he introduces this idea of entropy, because he said if you have a heat-powered machine, then if you add up the heat energy to the mechanical energy, it equals the same thing. So he first makes he says, therefore, we need a new type of thing, which he called entropy, which he says describes the state of organization or the ability of the system to continue to change, to continue to do work. And so he said that if you have an increase in entropy, it means that you have a decrease in the ability to do work, and a decrease in entropy means an increase in the ability to do work. He sort of made it inverse proportional. Mm-hmm. Then he makes this ridiculous statement at the end of his book. It's a very long book about machines. And at the very end of the book, he says, therefore, based on what I've said, it can be stated that the energy of the universe is constant and the entropy of the universe is tending towards a maximum. In other words, the energy of the universe is fixed. Nothing can be created or destroyed in the universe. And that the universe is always tending to be able to do less and less and less and less and less. Hmm. And first of all, it's absurd after a study of machines to make a statement about the universe as a whole. But secondly, his statement about machines is absurd too, because you don't really have a closed system. Yes, maybe a perfectly insulated machine where you have no heat loss might be considered theoretically a closed system. But that machine is created by a human mind. Mm-hmm. That machine is the invention of the mind. That machine is a new state of organization and existence which didn't exist until a mind thought about it, how to produce it. And then when you apply that machine in the economy, it also transforms the economy. So the whole thing is completely absurd, and nobody really bought into this thing as a scientific principle because it can't be proven. In the 19th century, around the end of the 19th century, where you had the rise of people like Nietzsche and all this pessimism that was leading into World War I, mm-hmm. then the acceptability of this kind of false scientific doctrine became greater.
But you also had at that same period, the late 19th, early 20th century, you had the work of Planck and Einstein. You actually had people who were rejecting this perspective and going back to Leibniz, going back to, as Einstein said, going back to Kepler.
And they were smashed. The revolutionaries who everybody realized were the revolutionary thinkers, and an actual political campaign within science was conducted and broadened out beyond science to basically ridicule them, isolate them, and to give rise to all kinds of strange doctrines consistent with the second law of thermodynamics, like the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum mechanics, and all these crazy ideas which people walk around today and spout because they read it on Wikipedia or something.
Well, this is what I'd like to get to in the last. We have about 20 minutes to go, and just to remind our listeners, this is the LaRouche Show. I'm talking with Bruce Director today. It's March 10th, 2012. Now, Bruce, the obvious implication, which you drew out very strongly in your speech in Berlin, is that if you actually try to impose these laws, impose them as policy through the green movement and the attack on science, you actually do create the conditions for extinction of mankind. And I'd like you to just draw the connection between the fraud of the second law of thermodynamics and what's being done in the name of saving the environment today.
Well, if you look at, again, the history of mankind, you see that the empire systems have always been based on trying to maintain a social equilibrium, a steady population, they don't like population increase, to try and maintain a fixed relationship between man and nature, like the feudal system of serfs and lords and so forth, a limit of technology, all these kinds of things. And any system which has organized itself that way, any social system from the Persian Empire, the Babylonian Empire, other Oriental empires, you see this in the history of China, Japan, but also other places, primitive cultures, they all collapse. They all collapse because they reach a point where they can't sustain an increasing population, or they become overwhelmed by some physical catastrophe of which they lacked the moral and intellectual capacity to deal with, some earthquake or whatever. So you have this, if you look at the history of the development of the population of the planet, of human population, you see that it has this sort of long period of a couple million years of ups, very, very small peaks and small valleys, relative speaking on the scale. But there's a secular increase in population. Then in 1347, you have a huge drop-off in population where we got to the point where there was, in European culture, a collapse of a confrontation between the way people were thinking and organizing themselves and the physical conditions of life, which led to the spread of disease like the Black Plague.
Well, it was also a banking collapse.
Yeah. was the symptom of a collapse in social organization. And that led to a huge collapse in population. Some cities lost as much as 80% of their population. I think the average loss, averaged out over all of Europe, was around 50% destruction in population. But in all these cases throughout the history of mankind, any time there was a collapse of an empire, these empires were not worldwide empires. They might have been dominated a certain large section of the world and considered themselves worldwide empires, like the Roman Empire says they dominated all the world, but they just dominated the Mediterranean. You always had other parts of the world where mankind was developing. Now we've gotten to the point where there is no part of the planet which is really independent of any other part of the planet. There's no part of mankind which could survive an extinction, as we now see with the threat of nuclear weapons. I mean, every human being is threatened by a confrontation between the British Empire in control of America's nuclear arsenal and Russia and China. So it's the first time in history of mankind that you've actually had the potential for a worldwide collapse. And the confrontation here, as LaRouche has really pointed out, is that the British Empire is committed right now to reducing the world's population to about 1 billion to 2 billion people, which is, in effect, you know, an application of the second law of thermodynamics. They're saying that the balance of nature is out of whack, and the only way to get it back into balance, into equilibrium, is to kill about 6 or 7 billion people.
And this is what the real intent is behind such things as the carbon dioxide swindle and the global warming, man-made global warming, and so on.
And their opposition to nuclear power, their opposition to fusion, and their insistence that countries like Russia and China, which do possess technology, not invest that technology, not invest that know-how in terms of development of their territory, like Russia development of the Siberian area or China development of its interior. So The British are saying Russia, China, and every other country on earth must submit to our intention to reduce the population to 1 billion people, or else we're going to go to war in order to assert it. So we're stuck in a situation where if Russia and China resist, you get nuclear war. If Russia and China capitulate, you get
mass kills.
You get mass kills. Yeah. So the point is there's only one way out of this thing, which is to destroy the British Empire. You can't compromise with it. You can't negotiate with it. The empire system has to be eliminated as a social system in human history for the first time that we know of.
And I think, Bruce, it's important to make the point here that the so-called science of the imperial system is actually what is destroying the quality of human life and the potential of mankind to make the discoveries that would enable us to survive this travel into this very dangerous part of the galaxy.
Well, the irony is when you look at what we have available to us in science, with the new understanding of principles of life and physics and how the mind works, you know, it's really just fascinating. There's no reason why there should be a single person on this planet going hungry. There's no reason why there should be a single person on this planet who doesn't have access to clean water, a decent house, living, transportation conditions, which enable the every human being to be able to free themselves up physically to develop the powers of their mind. There's no reason why, if you had cooperation between Russia, China, India, and the United States and other countries, Japan, Europe, and so forth, to put our scientific research together, that we couldn't develop industrial capacities on the moon, colonize Mars, be sending probes deep out into the, not just the galaxy, but beyond. Mm-hmm. So it's really, you know, when you stop and think and deal with this, you see that it's really, really possible to have a development of mankind that we've never had before in history, and yet we're standing on the verge of potential extinction. And so that's really the choice that's really sort of the branch point that the world is in right now, and it's really a matter of choice.
There are two things that come to mind on this when it comes to how do you use this knowledge of the human mind, the work that LaRouche is doing, the revolutionary papers that he's producing that we're putting up on the website. I mean, the fact is that this material is there. We've seen the basement videos, the weekly report, the discussions, and yet this isn't going to change society unless there's a fight around these things. On the one side, we see the work that we're doing with the campaigns in Germany, for example, against the environmentalism led by Helga Zeppler-Rusch. But how do we get how do we provoke a fight in the scientific community here, Bruce? How do we take the honest scientists who actually still believe that there's some principle of truth out there, how do we get them on the right side so they not just fight for real science, but recognize that they also have to apply their powers of reason to politics?
Well, I think you have to take it into the streets. And as you know, we're having a great debate sometimes, even within our own ranks, about the importance of taking out into the streets and educating the ordinary population and getting this thing out as widely as possible. You're not going to get everybody to understand all these principles, but you're going to find the thinkers. And the thinkers are the ones who are going to determine the direction of society. You know, I like to point out to people when they ask questions like that, like how are you going to get these ideas across, I say, well, think about it. Socrates was a street organizer. I mean, you know, ideas are very, very powerful. And especially if they're communicated from one human being to another, as opposed to just, you know, passively like our current digital technologies and internet do. They can be useful, but they can be useful only to the extent that they're made to submit to the to the creative powers of the mind.
Well, in that sense, look what Socrates did. He developed this idea of the dialogue as the means by which you educate.
Yeah.
Which with a discussion with another living mind.
Oh, he got killed for it, but, yeah. You know, that the point is, who won? As he said to the jury in his trial, he says, you know, who's going to win this fight, you or me? He says, you know, I'm an old man. I'm going to die anyway. If you wait a few years, you'll get your wish. But who won, Socrates or the people who hung him? The point is that mankind can actually enter a new era. I think Helga LaRouche called it the getting out of adolescence and finally growing up. And I think, how are you going to get people to grow up? It's not a question of chronological age. It's a question of getting people to face the reality of where we are. And I think that's what Lynn and Helga have really been trying to get people to realize. You know, let's cut out all the obfuscation here, the sophistry and so forth, and get real. I mean,
well, you see that with the developments these last days of the Walter Jones resolution. Going back to the end of October, Lynn has been insisting, even while he's been working with the basement to get these ideas out, he's been insisting that in terms of our activity, we have to stick to the idea that we're facing a thermonuclear World War III, and we have to intervene to stop it, and that means getting Obama out. And if you look back over the last months, on any given day, you could say, well, look, we say that to a lot of people. It's on our website, it's in our leaflets, and if our candidates are saying it, but nothing's changing. And yet you look now from where we are today, and you realize that we haven't had a nuclear war. We've seen more people coming out and making very strong stands against what the British are trying to do. And I think from that standpoint, you see that these kinds of street fights do have an effect.
Absolutely. And they change the world. And you can see this with what we're doing with the candidates in the United States. You can see it with Jacques' campaign in France. The point is not to sit here paralyzed with fear and pessimism when faced with this situation, because we don't have the masses out there in the streets. The point is to realize that it's never, as Lynn points out often, it's not popular opinion. It's not what's popular which saves mankind. It's what appears to be completely unpopular but happens to be true.
Well, you can only wage the fight on the higher principles anyway. If you look at what Jones did, he raises the constitutional issue. And if you really want to look at the question of how you solve the current crisis, it is with that constitutional principle, just as well with Glass-Steagall, with the American credit system. And so the only way to fight this is by raising people's standards to discuss these questions of principles that are knowable.
Well, it's what Lynn always says about practicality. I had a meeting in Germany with a young man who was a engineer physicist who works at a big company there on long range planning. His purpose of his division in the company is to come up with forecasts of 25 to 50 years what the requirements are going to be for the steel and machinery that this company produces. So he was looking, they're looking at silly things like, you know, okay, Mexico City now has 25 million people in it, and 50 years from now it'll have 100 million people. So how much of a sewer system are they going to need for 100 million people in the city? So we laid out our proposals for the Bering Strait Tunnel, for space development and NWAPA and these kinds of things. He said, well, that's a completely different approach, but the politics won't let it happen. I said, well, you got to change the politics. And he said, well, that's not what we do in our company. But that's the reality that people have to be confronted with. When you look at the reality of the situation here, it's the politics that has to change. So people should stop complaining about the politics and get out and change the politics. You got a stupid theory called the second law of thermodynamics, which is a complete fraud. And most people have never heard of it, but they believe it like it's a religious doctrine. And they ought to dump it and start to stand up on their own hind legs and get mankind in shape. And it's the politics that has to change, and people can't keep running away from it.
Well, Bruce, is it your sense that there are people in the American scientific community who can take up this question of the second law of thermodynamics, or is the brainwashing and the peer review so strong that it's impossible to get these questions debated?
Oh, no, they do it every day. You know, creative scientists are confronted with the reality of the world, and they use their minds to figure out how it's working. And then you do have a certain Babylonian priesthood which tries to make everybody pay obeisance to stupid ideas. And oftentimes that hinders creativity. But if you know, it can be turned around very quickly. If you have the kind of crash programs that LaRouche is talking about, you'll free scientists up very, very quickly to take this on. I mean, they're not unaware of it. There was a conference, I think, in 2007 at MIT called Meeting the Entropy Challenge, in which they had scientists from all over the world come to discuss the problem of the fact that the second law of thermodynamics, it seems to be violated by everything we discover in science. And the task of the participants at this conference was to figure out how to explain, you know, how to save the second law of thermodynamics from extinction. And they basically admitted the only way they could do it is by brainwashing physics and chemistry students to accepting it. But they're aware of it. The biggest point is it will disappear as rapidly as the flat Earth societies or the people who believe that the Earth was at the center of the solar system as soon as you unleash mankind politically.
Well, and there's an old tradition in the United States, which probably goes back to Benjamin Franklin and the Constitution, which has there's a commitment to scientific and technological progress, and in particular, a real interest in science.
Yeah, and if you think about Kennedy in the space program and the cultural and psychological effect that it had for the President of the United States to launch our nation on a scientific mission that was daunting but didn't seem doable, but it mobilized, it unleashed, it was the President of the United States saying, our nation is committed to creativity. You have permission and the support of the government of the United States to be creative, to make discoveries, to come up with new ideas. And that, if you unleash that, forget it. People are not going to care about some stupid mathematical theory like the second law of thermodynamics. They're going to be thinking about, you know, what can my mind do and what kind of creativity can I inspire in others?
Well, I would encourage our listeners to go to the LaRouchePack.com website. And you'll have to dig around a little bit, but I think actually it's up on the main section of the homepage, the Berlin Conference, and you can go there and you can see Bruce's presentation. There's also a presentation from Sky Shields from that conference, as well as the keynotes from Lyndon and Helga Zepp LaRouche. Now, I also want to let our listeners know that half hour after the end of this program, Lyndon LaRouche will be addressing a series of a group of six town meetings. All of the candidates of the LaRouche slate are holding town meetings across the country today that will be addressed by Lyndon LaRouche, and I'm sure he'll take up this question of Walter Jones, and I'm sure he'll also do everything the way he usually does to smash any attempt to try to curve fit this into a pragmatic approach to the presidential election campaign. So I believe that's going to be on LaRouche Pack Live, so you can see that in a half hour. Lyndon LaRouche has addressed the six town meetings. And Bruce, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. This is obviously cutting edge material. This is from the basement, from what you presented. It's clear that there's a world out there that's being hidden from most people.
It sure is. So don't trust your senses. Go out and see the world as it actually is, not as it appears to your senses.
Okay, well, and so with that, we'll bring to a close another LaRouche show. We'll be back next Saturday at 3 p.m. And again, Lyndon LaRouche in half an hour on LaRouchePack.com. Make sure you see it and get your friends to see it. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.